Is there continuity between the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the Black Lives Matter movement of today? Hello, and welcome to Race Matters, a conversation of substance about one of our nation's most uncomfortable topics. I'm Marilyn Bell, Art Director at World Literature Today magazine. The civil rights movement of the 1960s brought forward concerns about voting rights, segregation, and proportional representation. While the focus of racial protest has recently shifted to aggressive policing and inequities in the criminal justice system, the goal of organizations like Black Lives Matter remains the same: to secure freedom and justice for all Black lives. We've asked a veteran of the civil rights era and lifelong educator and activist, Dr. George Henderson, to share his thoughts on the civil rights movement in relation to Black Lives Matter, today on Race Matters. In 1967, George Henderson became his university's third African-American professor, and he and his wife became their community's first Black homeowners. Throughout his career, he has served as an advisor and mentor to young Black students and fought alongside them to improve race relations on university campuses. Dr. Henderson is an illustrious professor who's authored 29 books, the most recent of which is his memoir titled Race and the University. Dr. Henderson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to start by asking you for your thoughts on the most recognizable name in the current civil rights scene, being Black Lives Matter, which was founded 3 years ago by Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and Patrice Cullors in response to the killing of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. What are your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think it's a continuation of something that was started in the 40s, continued in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. To disassociate what they've done with the civil rights movement does the movement a disservice. I think it's an extension of. When you talk about it, if we talk about it that way, it's like saying we have a post-racial society now. We don't have a post-civil rights society. We have a continuation of that civil rights movement. What they've done is courageous. What they've done is to focus on a new kind of leadership, a kind of leadership that's very, very right for the 21st century.
During the civil rights movement of the 60s, people rallied not only behind the cause, but behind the men at the center of the movement, Dr. King and Malcolm X. Black Lives Matter was founded by three women, but they've made a concerted effort not to establish a central figurehead for their cause. Do you think that this decentralized way of organizing helps or hinders their cause?
It obviously is helping. We needed central leaders in the 40s or 50s or 60s and so forth. We don't now. It's a different time. We're different people. And I think social media has made it a different time. It's helped. It's helped, and perhaps we've taken that next step. We needed central figures at the time when we started what we were doing. Now we don't. It's a people's movement, as we always wished that it had been. It wasn't, so therefore we had our leaders.
I'm glad that you mentioned the leaders, because I wanted to talk to you about your experience meeting both Dr. King and Malcolm X. In your memoir, Race in the University, you detailed your journey all the way from childhood that led you to university teaching. And while you were living in Detroit, you had the opportunity to meet and work with both Dr. King and Malcolm X. So I wondered if you would briefly tell us about your encounters with both men, starting with Dr. King.
It's always difficult for me to do what you're asking me to do because it was an association, it was a loss, and I but it was a pleasant memory. So, yes, I'll respond to that. We are contemporaries. We're peers, really. Not much age difference between us. So I was a follower of a peer. Meeting Dr. King was a highlight of my professional life, not for the reasons that many people think, but to have him point me in the direction of what I must do. I noticed when I first met him that in any meeting, if it was a public meeting, he would go immediately to the children, kind of bypass us older folks, the parents were there, and he would go to the children. One day I asked him, I was director of community service of the Detroit Urban League in the early 60s, why the children? He said, that's what we're about. And I still remember those words. It's not about you, George, or me. It's about these babies.
And why do you think he felt that was the case?
Because it was. He saw our future. He saw the possibility of not just focusing on the generation that was here now, the elders, but those who are going to be the elders tomorrow, and what will they teach their children, and whether you see where it goes. Actually, it was a tactical stroke that was absolutely right. It was spot on. It has always been about the children. That taught me, for example, when I teach, I tell my students, this is not about me, it's about you. I learned that from him. Why did he do it? Because America had grown tired of watching men brutalize one another. We even institutionalized it. We called it professional football. We called it boxing and wrestling. But America had never, never grown tired of people not brutalizing children. And so, therefore, he put the focus where it should be. That's why he did it. It was for them.
So you met Malcolm X after Dr. King, is that correct?
That is correct.
And he recruited you, as you talked about in your memoir, he recruited you to join his movement. Can you tell us about that meeting and about the decision that you ultimately made after that meeting?
Actually, a decision my mother made for me before that meeting. Let me explain that. When I met Malcolm, also about my age, Malcolm was very, very clear about what he needed. He said, I need the young black intellectuals, and I was one of them, to be part of the movement. I need the teachers. I need the poets. I need the essayists. I need the story to be told in the classrooms and in the community through the intellectuals. Would you join me? And I said, no, I'm committed to Martin. Now, this is how my mother came in. When I was very young, my mother would always say to me, George, you run with the devil 6 days a week, Sunday's church time. This is not a discussion. I'm telling you what you're going to do every Sunday. Initially, I thought my mother really was being my social secretary. All the girls were there. And then when I got tired of chasing the girls in church, I started listening to the sermons. And always the thing that would strike me would be when there was a sermon and my pastor would say that suffering is redemptive and we must love one another. I was committed. I was committed to nonviolence. I was committed to the concept of love and suffering being redemptive because of the ministers, and Martin was one of them. He wasn't my minister, but he had the same basic message. So I was ready for him. But Malcolm he was a gentleman about it. He said, I understand that, but will you make me a promise? I said, what? If you can't help me, will you promise never to hurt me? I said, of course. And then I kind of cavalierly said, and will you make the same promise to me? And we both laughed. Because of that contact, when the Hendersons came to Oklahoma, I was the only professor at the University of Oklahoma who had a contact with the black Muslims in Oklahoma City. Theodore G.X. was from Detroit, and I had met him, and we kind of got together again. So I spent the early years between all of the things that I was doing also working with the black Muslim children in Oklahoma City. That was a relationship. That was the relationship that Malcolm made possible.
Modern social justice movements are increasingly shaped by social media, as we've discussed. Black Lives Matter, for example, started out as a hashtag on Twitter. How do you think Black Lives Matter will be shaped by its continuing close attachment to social media?
It will reshape itself. It will change. It will morph because it has the ability to move to the next social media media that's effective. I think it has the kind of dexterity that we didn't have. In the early years of the civil rights movement, we had a national press. We didn't have the ability to reach the masses as they do now. How will it change? Lord knows. I'm the person who said I would never see a black president. So you're asking the wrong person to tell you how it's going to change.
I want to go back to one of the teachings of Dr. King that you really embraced, which is his encouragement toward nonviolent protest. Why did you feel nonviolence was the correct tactic for achieving justice?
For practical reasons. I've never really been an idealist per se. I read Gandhi as King had read Gandhi. Gandhi's resistance movement was based on not fighting back for very practical reasons. The British had all of the weapons, most of the weapons. They could have done to the Indians what the settlers did to our Indians if we had fought back. It was a practical reason, but it was also the right reason. But Gandhi was also impressed by he wasn't a Christian, as you know, but he always referred to some of the concepts and some of the things that Jesus said, and love was one of them. He always focused on that. So practically, he said, if the Indians are going to get their freedom, they must get their freedom not through violence, but teaching their enemies. You will know you have won, he said, when you kill the person who's trying to kill you, but when you kill in them the need to kill you. It's true. It's absolutely true. We could not have won that one. Oh, when I was much younger, I said to my colleagues, I've got an idea. Let's declare war against the United States. We'll lose. They'll bomb out our houses and everything, but they'll rebuild them like they did in Europe and in Japan. I was tongue-in-cheek. No, they wouldn't rebuild them. We have yet to rebuild the slums. Nonviolence was our way. We had to go. Fighting? No. Love? Yes. Turning the other cheek was not easy for me. The concept of love wasn't easy for me. When I grew up, I was taught the first gift my father gave me was boxing gloves. And so here I am. My mother's sending me to church. My preacher's telling me to be nonviolent. My father's telling me, fight back. I was torn. But doggone it, my mother said, you never really win by hurting other people. That's why Dr. King was telling me the same thing. If you're going to die, die peacefully. It's your choice. It's not your enemy's choice. Fighting back is their choice. They want you to do that. You mentioned the new student movements. We needed the media to see cruel people doing some very ugly, cruel things to nonviolent people, so that the world would say enough. But we also, and this is something that we never really discussed openly, it was almost as if it was a given, but none of us really wanted to talk about this. We needed martyrs. We didn't want them, but we needed martyrs. Men are not martyrs. Women and children are martyrs. Lord knows that this is something we didn't want to talk about. It wasn't accidental, therefore, that the babies and the mothers, the women and the children, were front line. That wasn't accidental. If the world saw that, which they did, being prodded by cattle prods and beaten and gassed, and the world did say enough. It also embarrassed President Kennedy. He wanted to talk about democratizing Europe and other places in Cuba. And the spectacle of us here not really having our freedom, he wanted us gone in, as second-class citizens so he could get on with his agenda. I'm so glad that he decided that he had that other agenda. So that's why it worked.
This is Race Matters. I'm Marilyn Bell. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. George Henderson about Black Lives Matter and the modern civil rights movement. Dr. Henderson, how has the increased ability for people to photograph and film interactions between the police and the public, and then distribute them widely via social media, changed the nature of the conversation about race?
It's changed the nature of our reality. Public events, it's an oxymoron. There are no public events per se anymore, because in every public space, someone has the possibility and the probability of filming you. So that's how it's changed the face of it. Let's face it, you can do this now with your cell phones. The cameras that we had were archaic, you know. Good gracious, you take a picture and you wait a few days for it to be printed. It's instant now. It's changed. It has absolutely changed the nature of relationships. It allowed the good things and the not-so-good things to be seen instantly.
Now that we have the knowledge that we do, thanks to these advanced technologies, do you think it makes it harder to still advocate for nonviolent responses?
Harder? It doesn't make it harder to advocate for it. It makes it more difficult now. On the one hand, we through the media that we have young men and young women seeing things that are sometimes very, very cruel, very harsh. It makes it harder because we don't have the buffer effect, and the buffer effect happens to be this. The reason that we're so successful with minimizing the violence was that we would go to a church and we would have someone talk about what are we going to do about this situation. Now we don't have the opportunity to bring people together and say, what are we going to do about this situation? So consequently, what it does, it means that we have more individuals who are likely to feel that they want to strike out as opposed to being nonviolent, and we don't have an opportunity to tell them why that's not the best way to proceed.
In a recent interview with the Oklahoma Daily, you spoke about your experience fighting for civil rights in the 60s through the 80s, and one thing you said struck me. You said, quote, "We were waging war, and we declared victory, but we had only won some battles." Why did you say that?
Because the war is never over if it's war against bigotry. Until these things are true, the right to be free implies the right to be different. None of us is truly free until all of us are free. We won some victories initially for black men. Make no mistake about it, the civil rights movement, the successes that we had were mostly for people like me, black men. Think about it. 1963, March on Washington, there were 10 major speeches given, all men, mostly black men and a couple of white men. Coretta Scott King was furious. She said, "Martin, why can't you at least have a female as a major speaker?" Response, "We're not ready for that yet." So I guess I'm saying it was progress. We had won a lot of victories for men. We left behind victories for women, for people of other racial and ethnic groups, for individuals who had gender differences. We left a lot of folks behind. And most of all, we left the poor behind. Martin was bankrupt as a leader towards the end of his life. Malcolm was climbing as a leader. Their lives crossed in some interesting ways. Towards the end of his life, Martin was almost bankrupt. Towards the end of his life, Malcolm was indeed perceived as the young, bright stars. Martin wanted to have a poor people's march, which happened, but you know, I don't remember hearing anybody say that this is what Martin would have wanted. We did it. I guess the reason I say that we didn't win the war, we would have won the war if we had then won the war for poor people, because that includes all of us. Poverty is an equal opportunity afflictor. We won the war, as I repeat again, for black men. We lost, incidentally, in some of those battles, we lost white women towards the end of the civil rights movement because they said, what about us? And arrogantly, some black civil rights leaders said, your time will come, but now we must take care of the men. They said, fine, we'll take care of the women. And they did. That's why I said, we won many things, but we didn't win that war.
Do you feel that there is still an opportunity for the rights that you sought at the time for women, for the poor, for other people who weren't black men to still be gained now through the Black Lives Matter movement or other movements?
Of course. If I didn't believe that, I have no reason to get up in the morning. I might as well just keep my eyes closed and check out of this world. Of course I believe it. I must believe that. That's the reason that I still breathe, because I'll do everything that I can to push that agenda forward. But make no mistake about it, I'm realistic enough to know that when Martin Luther Jr. told us, I have been to the mountaintop and I will not be with you much longer, he was talking about his journey. But he was really telling the rest of us old men now, you're going to take the same journey. Yes, I believe it's going to happen, but I don't think that I will be there to see it happen. But then we become the equivalent of Moses. We can take them up to and point them in the direction of that promised land, but we are not going to go there with them. So yes, I believe it. I believe with every breath that I take, I believe it with every beat of my heart. And it must happen. It has to happen. I was hypnotized by the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice. It was that last word that got me. A poor 8-year-old in special education reciting those words for all, not for poor people like me, not for segregated black people, just for segregated black me left out, not for on and on and on. For all of us, yeah, it's going to happen. It's going to happen because that is our destiny as a nation. That is our destination as human beings. There's only race of any significance from my perspective. That's the human race.
In your memoir, Race and the University, you talk about the dehumanizing effect of ambivalence. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
I've lived with you. I've worked for you. I've built for you. I've taken care of your children. I've taken care of my children. I've fought in wars. I've died for you. I've done all of these things. You still are ambivalent about whether I should be free? I, too, am America's Langston Hughes, wrote. And it's that kind of ambivalence. But doggone it, the children that I see now, my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, reflect the world that I think we're moving towards. My family's multiracial, multi-everything. You think of a social problem, I've got some representatives. They're all there in my family. So you could say I'm selfish. I want all of my children to be taken care of. Or you could say that I'm an idealist. I believe that they will be.
What do you say to people whose ambivalence comes from their lack of understanding about what they can do to fight racism, to the person who does recognize other people's humanity, who does feel like Black Lives Matter but feels tied. They don't know what to do.
There's always something all of us can do. We don't have to think globally. We don't have to think locally on a broad scale. Each of us can do whatever we can do in our homes, on our playgrounds, in our workplaces. What I can do... So in our neighborhood, it doesn't matter. You can do something. But my question to them always is this, and don't agonize about what you can't do. Tell me what you can do and do it. Don't sit here and say, if I had more money or more time or more influence, use the money or time or influence that you have and do something with it. So that's how I deal with that. No, I may not have an opportunity to make broad strokes and create a beautiful picture, but I can make a small stroke and start painting that picture.
Can you give us an example of one of those small strokes that you'd recommend to someone?
Just finished teaching a class, and one of the students said, when I entered this class, I was determined that I wasn't going to say anything because I can't make a difference. She says, I'm leaving this class now knowing that when you told us that we must exercise and use our voice, and when I did this, she said, I understood. I made friends in this class that I thought I would never make. That's the first step, isn't it? That's what it is. We do it one person at a time, one household at a time, one neighborhood at a time. That's how we do it.
You mentioned earlier that you're not expecting huge leaps and bounds within your lifetime regarding the progress of civil rights in the country. But are there smaller steps that you hope to see us take as a nation?
I've seen more things happen than ever I thought would happen. But I'm an impatient person. Someone asked Martin once, well, what do you want? He said, I want it all. I want it now. I still have that kind of patience. And I realize that if we discount the gains that we've made, we trivialize them. And they're all building blocks. And they're all foundations to the bigger house that we're building. So I count the little things that have happened to me. And other people say they're big things. I don't know. Whatever we do, if we're better people today than we were when we woke up yesterday, that's progress.
Dr. George Henderson, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. George Henderson is a longtime professor at the University of Oklahoma who has held a number of leadership positions, including serving as Dean of the College of Liberal Studies. His memoir, Race and the University, was published in 2010 by the University of Oklahoma Press. Now we want to hear from you. Share your thoughts with us via Twitter at Race Matters Show, or send us an email with your suggestions for upcoming episodes to racematersshow@gmail.com. Race Matters is produced by KGOU in partnership with World Literature Today magazine, your passport to great reading. Views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the staff or management of KGOU or World Literature Today. Our producers are Jim Johnson and Paige Willett-Lowe, and I'm your host, Marilyn Bell. Thanks for listening.